I'm Sammy Mack.
And I'm Elaine Chen. We're sitting in for Tom Hudson.
Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. A couple of years ago, Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe County all got together, looked at sea level rise projections for South Florida, and decided they needed a plan. What they came up with was the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Action Plan, which makes recommendations on everything from development regulation to infrastructure considerations. Even though Palm Beach County was one of the driving forces behind the plan, it didn't sign the pact until just this week. Joining us to talk about how the counties are handling sea level rise is Patricia Mazet from the Miami Herald and Andy Reid from the Sun Sentinel. So, Andy, what changes now that Palm Beach has signed the pact?
Well, the county affirms its commitment to following through on the climate change efforts that it helped create. The four counties came together in 2010 to come up with this approach to dealing with this long-term problem, and then it was up to the counties when the plan came out in 2012 to officially sign on. Palm Beach County was the last to do it, so now they have committed to that and have to start putting into practice these as many of these 100-plus recommendations as they can.
And so what took them so long between when they helped develop the plan and when they actually signed on and said, yeah, we're good with it?
Right. Well, the county says, from the county perspective, they say they weren't objecting to the plan. They said they wanted to take the approach of having some public outreach before they signed on the dotted line. They met with, the county's got 38 cities. They started meeting with city leaders to try to talk to them about how they could be involved in this effort, which is really a regional effort. It's going to take a lot of parties being involved. They met with civic groups, they talked to business leaders, trying to diffuse some of the pushback that could potentially come from this idea of tackling a tough problem, but also creating expenses and costs and new regulations along the way. So the county says that that was a successful effort and that now is the time to sign on. They took some pushback from environmental groups and folks concerned about climate change who said, why are you taking so long? Let's speed it up. But ultimately, got it done.
And what were some of the specific concerns that they were worried that their cities and their businesses would have around this climate change plan?
Well, some of the plan's direction is taking a new look at how things are developed, where, you know, what land is available for development, what you're allowed to build when you do build, how you incorporate public transit into new development or redevelopment. A lot of it has to do with infrastructure costs, rerouting roads potentially, raising roads, just factoring in these additional efforts that add expense, add cost, potentially add regulation. And I think that was what the county was trying to diffuse, trying to build support for it before they just pressed forward with it. So we'll see. I mean, it's still very conceptual at this point. There's a lot of recommendations, a lot of things on the to-do list. But they're kind of broad.
So what are some of those things on the to-do list?
Well, it's things like add climate change to one of the factors you consider when you are deciding on whether to allow a farm to be turned into a new neighborhood. You know, you already have to consider things like, do schools have enough room for new students? Do the roads have enough room for new cars? Now you have to factor in what happens if the sea level rises, or, you know, what is the drinking water going to be there because of saltwater intrusion? So it's a new level of consideration that hadn't been factored in to the usual bureaucratic red tape process of getting something approved for development. So that's one of the things on the list, adding climate change to your development guidelines, identifying flood-prone areas. Obviously, that's something the county wants, local communities want to do anyway, but now it's, okay, yeah, it floods now, or it doesn't flood now. What about in 50 years when the sea's 2 feet higher? Is that become a flood-prone area, and how are you preparing to deal with that? It's coordinating, like we talked about, with cities to acknowledge that, look, this is a big problem. Palm Beach County can't do everything, literally, because the cities control what goes on in their boundaries, and so they want to bring the cities on board to go at some of these things, like what do you do with the road that cuts through your town, is close to the coast, is low-lying, the city may need help, county may need help, state may need to get involved, those kinds of efforts. It's encouraging more environmental restoration, restoring beach dunes, restoring wetlands, trying to, you know, build back some of the natural areas that have suffered from years of development and drainage, because now we see how important those areas are when things like sea level rise and climate change and losing wetlands, you know, the effects that those can have. So that's part of the plan.
So Palm Beach County signs on to this. How much do they have to follow? What's the pressure on them to stick to the plan?
Well, they helped create the plan, so there's that degree of commitment that they should do as much as they can. The plan is, like I said, it's about 110 recommendations. Some of them have little sub-recommendations. Some of them are very broad, like we were talking about, identify flood-prone areas, discourage development along the coastline, encourage biking, walking paths, things to try to get cars off the road, improve public transit. So you have a lot of those kind of open-ended ideas. The county's goal is, or the idea now is, that you've adopted the plan to start getting more specific. Of these 110 things, start incorporating that decision-making into everyday decisions, like whether to approve it or development, where to put the next bus route, what kind of cars to buy when you replace the sheriff's fleet or the parks and recreation fleet, things like that to reduce the greenhouse gas output, make adapting to climate change become more normal to daily life, not some jarring, it's time to move out of your house situation.
Right. Who ultimately ends up paying for implementing these changes?
Well, we do. People do. There's just no way around that. It's taxpayers. It's property taxpayers. It's things are, if you have to build a new drinking water well field, if you have to move it farther inland because the ocean is seeping into the one 5 miles from the coast, that's taxpayer money. If you have to relocate a road, that's, you know, that's the taxpayers doing that. The South Florida Water Management District has identified 28 flood control structures along the coast that are vulnerable to sea level rise, may not work if sea level rise projections come through. That's tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure that the canals that just keep South Florida dry during a normal rainstorm and send that, dump that water out to sea, will work when the seas are potentially, you know, several feet higher.
What's the first big change that's going to be made because of this plan, in terms of either a big project that's going to be now worked or come into fruition, or a regulation that's going to have to be changed now?
Well, the county will tell you that they've been making some changes in the last few years, much of it driven by budget concerns more than necessarily climate change. Improving efficiency, energy efficiency at government facilities, changing the light bulbs, making sure the water isn't leaking from every single faucet, making air conditioning systems more energy efficient. So they've been doing those kinds of things in recent years because it makes a budget sense, and it also factors into climate change effort. The next step is this boring sounding step of changing the development code, the comprehensive plan, quote unquote, which is like the constitution, the blueprint for growth in Palm Beach County.
Right. And this is really interesting because this is part of, you know, it's a really slow moving crisis. It involves a lot of wonky regulation. How do you get buy-in from people who are ultimately going to be impacted by this potentially decades down the road?
Yeah. And it's the next step that's the most difficult to maybe accomplish that. It's when it's, okay, now it's time to start building the new road. It's time to start building a new well or a new water plant or the new things that are going to have huge price tags. That's when you're going to get some pushback. It's when your business community is going to rise up and say, what do you mean I can't build a new high-rise condo on Singer Island on this piece of land that's sitting there and ready for me? What do you mean I have to set aside a few acres to create a new restored wetland next to my new neighborhood in the name of climate change? So when it starts becoming more tangible is when you're going to see some of that pushback, when budgets go up, tax rates.
Yeah, and we've got Patricia Mize from the Miami Herald on the line right now. Patty, what does this sea level rise pact have to do with Miami-Dade County's sewers?
Well, there was a lawsuit filed against the county, which was trying to reach an agreement with the feds and the state. The federal government accuses Miami-Dade of violating environmental regulations, including the Clean Water Act, by having so many sewage spills in the past few years. And there was a group called the Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper that sued to stop this agreement from getting enforced in federal court because the agreement didn't specifically list requirements for sea level rise in these sewer improvements. And there was a hearing earlier this year at the federal court. The judge finally signed the agreement last week, and he did not make these sea level requirements part of the agreement. He can't write them into it, but he could have asked the federal government, state government, and county government to come together on some sort of agreement. He seemed to accept the federal government's argument, which was this is a 15-year consent decree requiring Miami-Dade to spend $1.6 billion on improvements, and we can't ask them to make changes for 50 years down the line in a 15-year agreement. Not that climate change is not important to them, and the county has certainly said that they're going to take sea level rise into account, but there's nothing in this document that is going to force them to do so.
And how are the environmentalists who had been hoping to have that piece of it in there reacting to this?
They're pretty disappointed. The Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper attorney sent an email to his group and to their supporters last week after the judge's decision came down, saying that they were really hoping for more. All they got was the judge to stiffen some of the penalties against Miami-Dade County if it doesn't comply with the consent decree. The judge also keeps the power to appoint a special master down the line to oversee these projects if need be, but he's not requiring it from the beginning, which is what the environmentalists wanted. Essentially, you have the activists saying, we don't really trust the county to follow through on this plan or on its promise to take climate change into account. And they were really hoping for something a lot stricter to require the county to take some of these steps.
So Patty, I mean, this isn't maybe another example then how even though Miami-Dade County has signed this climate change, regional climate change plan with the other counties saying that it would take into account climate change in all of its infrastructure planning, that environmentalists don't really think that that's necessarily going to happen.
It's a money problem, really, because what the advocates say is, if we're requiring the county to spend $1.6 billion, let's make sure that this is money well spent on things that, improvements that are going to last for a long time. And if we don't require these more expensive fixes, basically costing more than $1.6 billion over the next 15 years, then the county's not going to have the money to do them just on their own. I mean, this is already a community that is looking at cash flow problems in certain departments. The water fees are going up just to fund this. So they just don't think that they're going to take the additional steps on their own, at least in that 15-year period. And the Fed said, well, we think climate change is perhaps the most important issue for the environment right now, but we can't force a 15-year agreement to take into account a 60-year decision.
That's Patricia Mazzei of the Miami Herald. We're also in the studio with Andy Reid of the Sun Sentinel. Still to come, carrying guns in a hurricane. Do you think people should be able to, regardless of whether they have it permitted or not? What was your experience during Hurricane Andrew or other disasters? Would you have felt safer knowing that you and others could carry a gun? That is a question that we are asking. We would love to hear from you. Call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. You can always tweet us at WLRN. Stay with us. The Florida Roundup on WLRN continues.
I'm Elaine Chen.
And I'm Sammy Mack.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. The state legislature is off this week for the Easter and Passover holidays, so all the budget negotiations and reconciliation of different House and Senate bills is going to start on Monday in the remaining last 2 weeks of session. So here to tell us what's in store during this crucial last stretch of lawmaking is Bill Cotterill, a contributor for the Florida Current and senior writer for the newspaper The Tallahassee Democrat, and Mary Ellen Kloss, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Welcome, Bill and Mary Ellen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Mary Ellen, probably the most important thing the legislature has to do each year is pass a budget. We've heard about a lot of initiatives that will require cuts or more funding, like the reduction of auto tag fees or paying for a few extra years to cover immigrant children. How do legislators bring it all together in one budget when there's still so many things that are pending?
Well, they will put together, they've already done two draft budgets. One is the Senate's proposal and one is the House proposal. And this weekend, they will get what is called the final allocation. So that's kind of the bottom line that everybody will have to spend in each of the budget categories. And then starting on Monday, they'll have the two conferees from each of the House and Senate meet, and we'll be working on finding the differences. Now, one of the things that I think is kind of surprising, and that is that it looks as though things were going pretty smoothly for the first 6 weeks of the session, and they may have hit a little bit of a roadblock here with an announcement on the as you referred to, that immigrant tuition bill. But we can talk about that later. But it looks like there may be a little of a hurdle and stumbling block as they reach the finish line here.
And I'm sorry, I just wanted to take a step back there. The final allocation, what is that? Is that the estimate from economists or?
No, that is this House and Senate leadership will give each of the committees kind of like the bottom line number that they can spend. And they get to then decide how much of that will go into the budget allocations that they've already designed, and then how much will go into local projects. And that's where there's the room and flexibility that, the one-time projects, the pet projects, the things that legislators need to take home for reelection. And that's where there is the most interest by lawmakers, because so much of the budget is already kind of predetermined. They don't have as much flexibility, but it's the areas of what can they take home to constituents that there's a little more movement.
And Bill Cotterill, what is the wiggle room there? I mean, Mary Ellen was saying there is so much of it that's predetermined. So how much, though, do legislators have to, kind of, lack of a better word, play with?
Well, there you have discretion. There'll be differences, of course, between the House and Senate. Let's take, just hypothetically, I'm making up this number, but let's say the leadership says, okay, transportation, you've got $2.1 billion to play with. And the conferees can then, within the limits of the cash they have, they can say, okay, we're going to use this much on four-laning something in Miami, or the Orlando Expressway Authority needs these facilities, and they can allocate the money as long as they stay within the $2.1 billion or $4.5 billion or whatever they're given to play with. Same thing, children and families, the needs for child protective services. They may take some more into, say, child protective services and some away from perhaps training facilities for staff, and allocate the money. Obviously, the House and Senate conferees usually will not agree to the dime going in. They'll negotiate, and of course, the agency heads come to these meetings, and the lobbyists, and they will try to shape these priorities. And each university, for instance, will have its representatives there working for more. The Seminole Tribe of Florida will have interests, things like that they're seeking. And as Mary Ellen said, the member projects, going home money, every member wants to say they got a new roof for the high school gymnasium, or they renovated the local National Guard armory, things like that. And here in Tallahassee, of course, the local delegation around here likes to get something for state employees, whether it be pay raises or some better benefits, insurance, things like that, protecting the retirement fund. So these are the sort of things that the negotiators, and they break into, they're not, to a giant House committee and a giant Senate committee that meets together. They break into health and human services, transportation, education, like that. And then at the end, they come back together with their products that have been negotiated. And there's a term they use here in Tallahassee called bumping up. If they cannot agree, let's say in transportation, there'll be several items on the list that they don't resolve. They'll bump those up to the committee chairman, Joe Negron in the Senate and Seth McKeel in the House. And then if the two chairmen don't agree on the priorities, they can bump them up to the presiding officers. the staff, of course, is very busily working all of this time and doing the real work. You couldn't expect any individual member, other than setting policy and telling the staff where to go, what he or she wants and does not want. But most of the real work and number crunching will be done among staff with input by the members and certainly by the agencies that are affected by this.
And so when does the Joint Committee start meeting then? When does that crucial last sort of set of meetings start?
They start on Monday. And one other thing that is different this year is that they have a budget revenue. Revenues exceeded expectations by about $1.3 billion. So that's all new money that they can spend over and above what they had last year. So that is obviously the place where they're going to turn to fund some of these local projects that Bill mentioned.
How did that happen?
Well, it's just the economy getting better. We've watched as there's been some job growth. There's been a turnaround in real estate. So things are slowly getting better, and that has resulted in more revenue increases. Sales tax revenues are up. Other tax revenues are up.
Something that I wanted to go back to, too, when Bill was describing all of the negotiations that happened is, how do legislators do all this negotiation and still comply with state laws that require open meetings? We have the Sunshine Laws that prohibit elected officials from discussing legislation while it's still pending unless they do it in a public forum with the public being able to weigh in and listen at least. But making deals is a pretty important part of how laws get made, and I don't think legislators want it to be out in the open that they traded a vote for one measure in exchange for a vote on another. Bill Cotterill, how do legislators do this then?
Pretty much, I would imagine, like in the private sector, although the private sector isn't required to meet openly, but the people with the power and the people with experience, the trusted minds, get together and discuss these things, make compromises. I think we all know that decisions are made and arms are twisted or promises are kept in the members' lounge, in the speaker's office. A long time ago when Lee Moffitt was Speaker and Curtis Peterson was Senate President, he was from Lakeland. I remember Peterson telling us the press was demanding to get in and watch him and the Speaker. He said, you know, we're going to smile and make nice and shake hands, and you guys will film that, and you'll go back to the TV station and say that's what happened. He said, you know perfectly well, if I have to start a sentence with "you stupid son of," he said, I'm not going to do that with you guys sitting here. I'm not going to call somebody in and relieve him as committee chairman or tell him he's not following orders. So you're not going to see the real game. But, of course, we in the press always keep pressing. We don't back off because of that. And there's something they call the bubble in the House and Senate. There are little conference rooms off the floor and where members can go and confer. And I don't think anyone would dispute that staff members, people who have great expertise and have run the computer numbers on, say, the Florida Education Finance Program, they're going to meet with their staff, and they're not going to notify the press 2 hours in advance and stand there in a room and do it. After most of the decisions have been made and discussed, and they have a pretty good idea what they can agree on and disagree, some of these conference committee meetings through the weekend will last 5 minutes. House will say, okay, we'll come up to your level on this, 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 and this. Senate will say, okay, we'll meet you on these items, and that leaves 17 others unresolved. We'll see you at 6 o'clock. And they go back behind their closed office doors, and they work with their staff. And I'm sure they pick up their telephones, and I'm sure the governor is having suggestions, and certainly the Senate president them and the lobbyists. But the only thing the law can really do is require that when they take the vote and they sign the document, they have to do that in public.
But when they're negotiating then and they're saying, look, we're gonna vote this way on this, and are you on board with that? That's not something that they have to do with 2 hours notice to the public?
The bottom line is that the staff can meet behind the scenes and negotiate, and they can be the emissaries of the direction from the leadership, which is usually what happens. in my experience, watching the conference committee is kind of watching kabuki theater. You really know that the people that are making the decisions are not necessarily the members on the committee, but the leadership, and it is a violation of Sunshine Law for them, for leadership to be talking to one another from each of the chambers, but it's not a violation for their staff to do it. Oftentimes the staff knows more about this than the members do, and we know that that's pretty much how things get worked out.
I think one great example, several years ago there was a trial of former House Speaker Ray Sansom. Before he was Speaker, he was Appropriations Chairman in the House, and there was a $7 million budget item that Mary Ellen's Capital Bureau there, the Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald Bureau, they had done a marvelous reporting job on this item that resulted in the Speaker leaving office and being tried, and ultimately they dropped the charge. However, the budget item was a one-page, very brief thing, said $7 million, Northwest Florida State College Airport Project, something like that, and handwritten on it, it said, per SD. And that means Speaker Designate. That means, why do we want to do this? Per the Speaker Designate. If the Speaker Designate wants something in his district, and he's going to be assigning you to your committee next year and your bills to other committees, it probably isn't a real good idea to stick your foot out and trip him. That's the sort of thing. Now, of course, this was a staffer had scribbled on the budget item per SD, which was all the explanation, I think, anybody, when they met publicly, when the House and Senate conferees met publicly, any member that looks at this and sees per SD on it isn't going to say, oh, wait a second here, what's this item? Why do we need to do this? It and dozens of others were quickly voted on and approved by the committee.
There has been, though, less activity on ethics reform this session compared to last year, but something that good government groups are trying to get more attention for is some bills that would make more documents and information off limits to the public. Barbara Peterson of the First Amendment Foundation says around a dozen exemptions to public records law are pending.
It will be a record number of new exemptions, and push the total number of exemptions to both the public records law and the open meetings law close to 1,100.
Bill Cotterill, the Florida Current, what are some of the notable exemptions that are being considered?
The one thing that comes up very, very frequently, and with, I imagine, some justification, they would like to example, for example, they would like to exempt the home addresses, email addresses of voters sometimes, which are important to political campaigns. If you're managing a candidate's legislative race and you want 1,500 email addresses of faithful voters who never miss a primary, and you'd like to contact them and offer them a absentee ballot, something like that, there are exemptions to withhold that. Of course, we'd all like to be protected from spam and from junk mail, things like that. But there are constitutional issues here. The courts have given greater leeway to political speech as opposed to, say, department store ads. So there's a constitutional issue there. Also, there's a law enforcement officer's home address is legally exempt because they don't want criminals trying to take reprisal or intimidate or threaten an officer or an assistant state attorney in their home. Well, there's a bill to extend that exemption, I believe. I don't know if it's still active, but Barbara and I have discussed this in the past, to include their wives, children, immediate family, like that. So if I go to our local superintendent of elections, Ion Sancho, and say, I'd like the home address and the contact information for John Smith, a registered voter, Ion would have to say, well, first, I'll have to make sure, not only make sure that he's not a policeman himself, but that he's not the spouse of a police officer or an assistant state attorney, something like that. And on mass requests of 1,500, 2,000 voter contact information, that could certainly delay and run up the cost, because when they fulfill these requests, an agency, I think quite reasonably, can charge the salary of the lowest paid worker capable of doing the job. If it's a mass request that's going to take 6-7 hours, the intent here, I think, looking at it the good way, the good intent is that they don't want some gadfly coming in and tying up the staff for a day and a half, and then when they get the information saying, oh, okay, thanks, and just turning around walking out.
Maybe because Mary Ellen, actually, so one of the, because one of the advocates for the these exemptions is the Florida League of Cities. Is that right?
Right. I mean, they're among other groups. I think that their problem is that they see that individuals are coming in and asking for these records, and it's expensive and costly, and they want to see a cap on that. They're using, rather than having their local governments deal with it aggressively and properly, they're going to the legislature to just kind of close the door on this stuff. And that happens pretty easily because it's easy to go to 180 legislators as opposed to 400 and some municipalities.
Transitioning to another issue that is, as it looks like, a bill that is likely to pass in the legislature. The legislature is likely to pass a bill that would allow people who do not and maybe even could not get a concealed weapons permit to carry a gun if there is a state-declared emergency. The Miami Herald's Fred Grimm called it the zombie apocalypse bill. Mary Ellen, what is this bill about?
Well, this is one of those, there's no problem, but just in case there might be a problem, we got to pass a law. This is a bill that is being promoted as a pro-gun bill, and the gun advocates in the state need something every election year to kind of go to voters and say, you know, we gave you more gun rights. So this is a bill that basically says that if there is an emergency, like a hurricane, and it's the governor's declared the state is in a state of emergency, you have a right to have your gun and bring it into a public situation. The defenders of this say that this is very important because, you know, when there is a lack of legal status in an emergency, people should be able to defend themselves. Now, of course, law enforcement is very opposed to this because they think it's going to be a case of, you know, people just getting out of control and using their gun to defend themselves and potentially cause more harm than good. So,
and Bill, I think you've told me about how the Sheriff's Association actually has some concerns about this bill. What are they?
Yeah, Sheriff Rutherford over in Jacksonville had a good example. He's their legislative for the Florida Sheriff's Association, their legislative director. He said, suppose there's an emergency, you're on Jacksonville Beach. What they want to do is clarify, put some time limits and some maybe constructive engagement that you're actually in the process of evacuating. It's not just a status thing where you are evacuated. He said, let's say you're on Jacksonville Beach, hurricane's coming, so you go over to Green Cove Springs. Now, a citizen in Green Cove Springs can't walk around with a pistol in his or her pocket without a permit, but you could because you're under evacuation. He said, when you get over there and you check into a motel and you get set up, okay, take the gun and put it back on the shelf. Don't walk around just because you're evacuated 100 miles away back home or whatever the distance is back on the coast. Shouldn't mean that you can now carry a concealed weapon without a permit. And he said the Sheriff's Association is not opposed to the bill. They wish to clarify what constitutes being actively engaged in the act of evacuating. Because understandably, a lot of people, because of looters, things like conditions like that, when they're packing up their belongings and fleeing a major hurricane bearing down on them or some other wildfire or some other disaster, they don't want to leave pistols lying around where perhaps looters could steal them. And on the other hand, if they're a law-abiding citizen but don't have a permit, they take the pistol, throw it in their pocket, and get in the car and go, and they're pulled over by a cop, say for speeding, something like that. cop pats him down, finds the pistol. Well, it's not like you wanted to go around carrying a concealed weapon. You were required to flee. So that's the argument in favor of this.
And this bill is likely to pass the House, I think, is what a lot of people are predicting. Oh, I'm sorry, the Senate. It's the other way. Yeah. It's passed the House, and it's likely to pass in the Senate.
Yes, it's cleared committee. Senator Jeff Brandis' companion legislation, I believe, is on second reading in the Senate. It's cleared committee. It's fairly non-controversial. And, I mean, by numbers, I believe the House was a little better than 2-1 in favor of it. Only 4 Democrats voted against it, and all the Republicans, 4 Democrats voted for it, and all the Republicans, 36 opposing votes were by Democrats.
The bill has been modified, as Bill mentioned, to include some of these provisions that are much more refined than it was originally. One of the other points is that right now, if you're in an emergency situation, you can't go out on the street and walk around with a weapon in your pocket, as he said. This would require that you no longer requires you to have to have it only in your vehicle or in a closed or locked container during an emergency. So,
well, we'll be keeping an eye out then on this bill and discuss it again after it looks like it's going to get its likely passage in the Senate. Still to come, remembering the FCAT, maybe fondly, maybe not. We want to hear your memories. Call us at 1-800-743-WLRN or 1-800-743-9576. And we'll hear some of South Florida poetry from our This Is Where project coming up after the break. I'm Sammy Mack.
And I'm Elaine Chen. We're sitting in for Tom Hudson.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking today with Bill Cotterell of the Florida Current, Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald, and John O'Connor, State Impact Florida in Tampa. So Tallahassee's been in recess all week, but the politicking continues. One of the education bills getting the most attention right now would expand a voucher program that provides state money for private school scholarships. Mary Ellen, what are the sponsors asking for? Oh, I think Mary Ellen might not be on the line, but John O'Connor, I know you've been following this. What are the sponsors asking for?
Sure. The bill initially would have...
I am afraid I can't hear John. So, Bill Cotterell, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Have you been following the voucher story?
Somewhat, yes. It appears to be a major point of contention. The Senate president wants to apply... accountability standards in requiring when schools qualify for vouchers, not just expanding the program, the pool. One of, I think, the philosophical differences is that Don Gates has said that he would like to apply the same measurement of student progress to these schools that are receiving voucher money. I believe the House is a little more interested, or primarily interested, in expanding the tax credit and getting the eligibility to more students whose parents can't afford to send them to better schools. And, of course, this raises the long-running argument. The Florida Education Association and others are just saying you're simply taking money away from further handicapping the struggling public schools and giving it... not only relieving corporations of some tax burden, you are giving the money to for-profit corporate schools. And Don Gates, who's a former school superintendent in Okaloosa County and former school board member, he seems pretty determined to require, and I have not followed this every day.
Well, I understand
he seems
very
serious about setting some accountability standards.
Yeah, I understand we have Mary Ellen back with us. So can you just explain what the deal is with this accountability requirement that would be added, you know, if he had his way?
Well, it's my understanding that the Senate president is supportive of allowing the private schools to have their own form of accountability. They don't necessarily have to take the state prescribed test, but there are series of other tests that are available that many schools already offer to their students. The issue is, should the results of those tests be available to parents, to community people, to the state to help evaluate the progress of students that are in private schools using the state-backed opportunity scholarships.
And what does it take for a student to get one of these scholarships?
Well, right now the requirements are that they have to be in an area where they are, in a school that is not performing well, and they have to meet income criteria.
Okay, and so if the accountability piece of this goes through, what does that change for those students?
Practically, I don't think it changes very much for the students, but it gives. It imposes maybe some new paperwork and some restrictions on the school that the schools generally, many of the schools are opposed to, and that is that they now have to turn over to school districts information about this group of students that isn't available for the school districts and the state Department of Education right now don't have. There are people that say that, if there's 4 kids on opportunity scholarships at a private school with 200 kids, and you turn over the results of this, you'll be able to identify how those 4 kids did, and that's a violation of privacy. There have been others who have suggested there are ways to get around this by, giving the number without identifying specifically and shielding some of that. So. They're still working. The debate is still pretty intensive, and I think that this is one of those things that, in the final weeks, is we don't know for sure, but I think it could possibly be part of the reason. It could be tied to some of the other things that are moving, and it's one of those hurdles that is enough of a conflict between the House and the Senate that it could blow things up.
Thank you. That is Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald. Thanks for joining us. And we do have on the line now John O'Connor, who's an education reporter with State Impact Florida and my partner in crime covering education. Hey, John, how's it going?
Good, Sammy. How are you?
Good. So one of the things that we were talking about this week is, of course, Florida students across the state are sitting for the FCAT one last time. The FCAT is dying. And when State Impact Florida spoke to former Governor Jeb Bush a year and a half ago, it was clear that the FCAT was on its way out.
The dreaded FCAT that gives all children acne and makes them nauseous during the testing period. It'll be replaced with a new test that will measure competency based on new standards.
So, John, what is that new test? What do we know about it?
Well, the new test doesn't have a name yet. The state has picked the contractor to design the test. They are the American Institutes for Research. The state has yet to finalize the contract with the company, so we don't have all the details on the exam. But what the Department of Education has told me is the test will be about as long as the current FCAT exams. There will be some differences, though, that this test will be all online. There will be things that they call performance tasks, performance items on the exam, which are kind of little puzzle or game-like questions that are open-ended and require students to drag items on the computer screen or, do some sort of task. And the test will be harder. At least that's the goal. That's the intent of the new spate of exams coming in across the country tied to these new standards that Florida and 44 or 43 other states have fully adopted.
Yeah, and I know, just from our reporting that one of the issues that teachers and superintendents are concerned about is that they haven't actually gotten to see this test up close and personal. So how is it going to be used? Because the FCAT was tied to all sorts of things, school grades, teacher pay, all sorts of stuff.
It's a big concern, and there's a really interesting thing going on here, too, in that initially they came out and said, well, this exam is going to be field tested in Utah. And that's sort of not really what's happening. What's actually happening is Florida is going to lease its test questions from Utah for the first year of the exam. That's next year, 2015.
Okay, what's involved in leasing a test question?
You pay the state and you pay Utah, and they let you use the question that they paid their money to develop. And so, and then the following year, 2016, the bidding documents say that AIR must develop all the questions specifically for Florida. So potentially you could have kind of a different set of questions one year and then these newly designed questions the next year. And so teachers and schools would likely have to make an adjustment for the test in 2015 and then get this new batch of questions and likely adjust again for 2016.
And I've been hearing some ambivalence about what that means. We've got a clip here from school superintendent of Miami-Dade County Public Schools, Alberto Carvalho.
With the death of the FCAT, it's almost one of those, you know, I didn't like you, but I miss you almost, because what's about to come may not be as clear as what the FCAT was.
That's Alberto Carvalho, the Miami-Dade County School Superintendent. So the FCAT still has one last run. Students are probably taking this as we talk, but Florida students aren't the only ones looking for themes and supporting anecdotes this month. It's April, so that means it's National Poetry Month, and WLRN has been celebrating with O Miami by hosting a poetry contest. We are also joined now by Mark Hedden, who's based in Key West. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty well. How you doing?
Good. So I understand you have been reading a lot of poems from our audience.
Yes, I have. Many, many poems.
So lay out the ground rules here. What sorts of poems are we collecting? What were we looking for?
Well, the poem can be anything. The two ground rules are it has to have the phrase, "This is where," in it. And it can't be too long, so usually about 14 lines or 30 seconds worth of reading.
And we actually have a clip here. This is from Juanita Cardona from Hialeah.
Teachers that only speak French, where I learned my first Creole words, sac passe ma boule. Friends from France, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Jamaica. This is where I became myself. Small but cozy, sit under the tree, talking among ourselves. Tears were shed, laughs were shared. Love was found in every corner, a corner that was beige. Where I ate my first crepe, spread with Nutella or sprinkled with white sugar. Hallway so small, only two bodies can walk side by side. Watching the rays of sunshine coming through the window, distracting. My cosmopolitan family.
That was Juanita Cardona from Hialeah reading her "This Is Where" poem. Mark, what do you hear when you hear that?
Well, I like some of the details in there. I'm a sucker for Nutella, so that's a good thing. I the description of the hallway being so narrow was just, you know, it brought you there. It brought you a visual idea in your head of what she was writing about, and that's good writing.
And a lot of these have these really great, wonderful moments. We've got another sample here from Letty Della Rocca of Delray Beach.
Day at Grinnell's Park. Pass a fat one. Seed pops. Burns a hole in my jeans. Tiny crater, falling star on a blue moon. Freaks at Coquina Castle sizzle with tie-dye, glitter. Paddy wagons come, cops with sticks, mace, loudspeaker ultimatum, disperse. Someone climbs the flagpole, smokes a joint under stars and stripes, high above hippies and pigs. This is where we chant, hell no, we won't go.
A very different kind of "This Is Where" poem, Mark Hedden.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was kind of, it's a historical poem, which is kind of fun. It's, you know, kind of the clash between the hippies and the police back in, what, 69 or 70, I think that was set in roughly?
Yeah, in Grinnell's Park. So you can submit your own poetry. You can go to WLRN.org and click on the hashtag "This Is Where." You've been listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks so much for joining you. That'll do it for Friday, April 18th, 2014. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or we'll post it on our website at WLRN.org. Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Public Insight Network analyst Steph Farrow. Our executive producer is Peter J. Merritt's technical supervisor, Paul Leary. I'm Sammy Mack.
I'm Elaine Chen.
Thanks so much for listening.